Our attention, as you may have gathered this morning, moves from the first of the Ten Commandments to the second. We move from the first commandment, which says, "You shall have no other gods before me," to the much longer second commandment found in verses 4 to 6 of Exodus chapter 20. "You shall not make for yourself a carved image, an idol, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments." Now, there is often some confusion in people's minds as to how this particular second commandment differs from the first commandment. And the usual explanation is this. In the first commandment, we are told not to worship false gods. And in the second, we are told not to worship the true God in a false way. Don't worship false gods, worship the true God in the right way, not in a false way. I've split this third commandment into three parts, because if you look at it, you will see that it is in three parts. And the first of those parts is what I've called the command. That comes in verse 4 and the first part of verse 5. The first part of this second commandment forbids the making of carved images, or as the New International Version puts it, of worshipping idols, or as the AV puts it, graven images. To grave in this particular context meant simply to cut wood or stone into an image. Now, lest we get the wrong impression, this command is not forbidding wood carving, stone carving, or even in modern day terms, painting, drawing, or photography and the like in their entirety, but only in so far as they will be used for idolatrous worship, for false worship. And when I say that, we have to recognize that sometimes when we start out doing something, it doesn't start out in any way being idolatrous. It doesn't start out in any way of being something that we will worship. But it can so easily turn into that, as we shall see in a moment. The command, as it relates to idols, is all inclusive. You shall not make anything in the form of an idol. It cannot be in the form of anything in heaven above, or on earth below, or beneath the waters. And as we've seen in our readings and know from our Bibles and our history books, that such idols were numerous, both in numbers and in forms. Brian Edwards, in his book, The Ten Commandments for Today, tells us the history of the human race is the history of idolatry. Every race and each generation manufactures its own idols in one form or another. Modern Western civilization is no exception. Right from the very beginning, right up to this moment and until the Lord Jesus Christ comes again. The human race will be a race of idolatry, a race of idolaters. God tells us that neither material nor form can be used to represent him. He is the creator and cannot and must not be represented by anything created or made. Yes, people may consider it an honour to have a statue or a painting made of them. But this is not the case with God. He forbids it because it is an insult or worse. He will not have it. The infinite God must not be represented by that which is finite. The living God must not be represented by that which is without life. The creator of all is not to be represented by something which is made. It is impossible, totally impossible, to make a true image of God, to make anything that will come near who and what God is, and must not therefore be attempted. This command is enforced, isn't it, by those words of our reading from Deuteronomy chapter 4. Listen again to verses 15 to 18. You saw no form of any kind the day the Lord spoke to you at Horeb out of the fire. Therefore watch yourselves very carefully, so that you do not become corrupt and make for yourselves an idol, an image of any shape, whether formed like a man or a woman, or like any animal on earth, or any bird that flies in the air, or like any creature that moves along the ground, or any fish in the waters below. Even when God was giving these Ten Commandments, what were the people doing? They were saying, make us a God. Make us a God we can worship. They just heard the voice of God. Moses was now up the mountain receiving the laws from God. And the people down below were saying, make us an idol. And they got all the gold. They put it in the fire. And they made a God. What was the God they made? It was a calf. Why did they make a calf? Because they'd been in Egypt. In Egypt, it was a bull. And the calf perhaps was like the bull. They were back where they were before in Egypt. Back in their old selves, not in their new selves. First part of this commandment is clear. You shall not make for yourself an idol. And the second part is equally clear. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. What is the purpose of making an idol? What was the purpose of those children of Israel making an idol when Moses was at the mountain? It was so they could see something, so they could worship something. And as soon as the calf was made, they worshipped it. We have a problem, don't we? We have a problem as the human race. We have a problem as people. And that problem is that we are people of sight rather than people of faith. We like to see things. We don't want to believe in things we can't see. We don't want to believe in the magician. We want to see how his tricks are done. We want to know how his tricks are done. Well, we can find that out quite easily, can't we? There are books which will tell us, people that will tell us. But when it comes to faith, there is no one who can explain what faith is or how faith works, except that it works because God is God. We're people of sight rather than faith. Give us something or someone we can look at and we're happy. But expect us to have faith in something or someone we cannot see. And it's an entirely different thing. The argument is made, isn't it? Give me something I can see, and it will help me focus my attention on God, whom I cannot see. Now, I guess if you asked people, even if you asked church people, you may find many, many people who say, that's true. You give some people something to look at, and it will focus them on God. They want to be seeing something. But is it not absurd to bow down to the work of man's hand when it is the maker of that man, the creator of that man, that we are worshipping? If I go out and build a wonderful statue, why should we worship that statue? Why should we worship the man who made the statue? There's only one to be worshipped, and that is God. What's the best we can worship apart from God? It's a moot point, but as I mentioned earlier, the sun, moon, and stars. Surely they're worthy of our worship. But God says in Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 19, and when you look up to the sky and see the sun, the moon and the stars, all the heavenly array, do not be enticed into bowing down to them and worshipping things the Lord your God has apportioned to all the nations under the heavens. They're not to be worshipped, and nor are images or likenesses of God. You see, the whole thing about these images, and it was the same with the sun, the moon, and the stars, is that people feared them. They feared the sun, the moon, and the stars. But they feared these images that were made. Or at least there was a thought behind the images. So you had to appease the gods. You had to make peace with the gods. And sometimes you had to make peace with more than one God. But you had to make sure that you gave the greater worship to the higher God and a lower worship to the lower gods. There was just one whole hierarchy of gods. And God says, look, even the sun, moon, and stars, they're my creation. They cannot hurt you. You don't need to worship them. Why don't we need to worship them? Well, again, it's absurd to bow down to an image or likeness of a king when the king is present himself. It's silly to worship the sun, moon, and stars when you can worship the creator of those things. Well, this two-part command is fairly straightforward, isn't it? Although it has to be said that there are churches that seem to steadfastly ignore it. You don't need me to run down other churches. I don't want to run down other churches. They have to answer to God themselves. But you know the sort of thing I'm thinking about, don't you? But there is, however, another aspect to it, and that is when something not intended to be an idol in effect becomes one. And that is what we need to be careful of. Making something an idol that we never, ever intended to become an idol. You may well recall the story of Moses in the wilderness when he made that bronze snake. Remember the story? The children of Israel, as usual, complaining against God. God sent down the snakes, they bit the people complained, they went to Moses. Moses said to God, can you do something? God said, make a brass snake, put it on a pole, and anybody who looks to that brass snake will be healed. Fine, it worked. But what happened? 2 Kings, chapter 18 and verse 4. Hezekiah, we're told, broke into pieces the bronze snake Moses had made. For up to that time, the Israelites had been burning incense to it. When it was made, there was nothing wrong with it. It was in obedience with God's command. They did what God wanted them to do. But then they began to worship it. Brian Edwards, again, in his book on the Ten Commandments, says at the time of the collapse of the Roman Empire in the 5th century, the church took over the images of the deserted pagan temples and occupied them as places of worship. They retained the images of the gods. Statues of Zeus and Isis were renamed Christ and Mary. They were left as aids to worship. But what happened? They became objects of worship in and of themselves. People began kissing the images, lighting candles, and burning incense to them, just as the Israelites had done. And people are still doing that. You can see it as you go into some churches. But we're no less guilty. We do the same today by making idols of our homes, of our cars, of our hobbies, of sport and leisure. We do it through our obsession with sex, money and drugs and by many other things, and also people. Many of these things are legitimate. Most of these things are legitimate in moderation. But when they overtake us and they take up all our lives, they become our idols. The moment we allow these things to command our attention more than the call of God to holiness or service, we're committing idolatry. You shall not, says God, make for yourself an idol, and you shall not bow down to them or worship them. And it must be said that what is true as far as God is concerned is also true with respect to the Lord Jesus Christ. It is not the work of man's hand, a sculpted or painted Christ on a cross, that we worship, but the divine Son of God. We need to be careful. And speaking of a cross there, we have to be wary of sometimes wearing crosses or having crosses in our churches, lest we worship them rather than the God and the Christ of the cross. So this is the second commandment. You shall not make, nor shall you bow down and worship idols. That's the commandment. The second bit is the cause, which we find in verse 5 and the second part of verse 5. What caused God to make this commandment? Well, we can be specific here, for in the middle of verse 5, he tells us what caused him to make it. He gives us the reason for it. He says, because I, the Lord, your God, am a jealous God. And it's one repeated in our reading from Deuteronomy 24, 4:24. Do not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything the Lord your God has forbidden. For the Lord your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God. Can we reconcile our God with a God like that? Can we reconcile our God as being a consuming fire, of being a jealous God? Some people can't, can they? Perhaps it's because of the way we think of jealousy. It's not something we would normally associate with God. But it's clear from the Bible that we ought to. God is jealous in two ways. First, he is jealous for his people. They are his delight. They are the apple of his eye. And he will watch over them and defend them. If you've got children, or more to the point, perhaps even grandchildren, you will know what this is all about. You're jealous for them. Anything that you see somebody doing that's against them, you'll be up in arms. You're jealous for them. You want the best for them. They are your delight. They are the apple of your eye. You want to defend them. This is so much more with God. And secondly, he is jealous of his people. And this is the jealousy shown here. He is jealous lest they go off after gods or worship him, the true God, in a false manner. Now, there is nothing on this earth that we can really, truly compare this with. We can only do it in a small way. We can say, let's take Ben Ainslie. You've probably all seen Ben Ainslie in the news this week. Supposedly, if you read some of the articles, he single-handedly won all those races. And some of those Americans who controlled the boat, some of those Americans who sailed the boat, they may think to themselves, why is he getting all the glory? Yes, he played his part, but he only played a part. Everybody seems to be worshipping him, whereas there were so many more people involved. And we get jealous, don't we? Those Americans are probably jealous of Ben Ainslie, because they're taking away something from him. And God is jealous when we go after other gods, because it's taking something away from him. Jealousy is defined as a warm, violent affection of the mind, either for or against anyone. For example, it's possible to be jealous of a rival sharing in our honours, as with Ben Ainslie, or our enjoyment. And so God is moved to jealousy when the honour due to him is given to idols. When we come to God, what do? We come to God as a bride to the bridegroom. And it's spiritual adultery to indulge in idolatry or image worship, no matter how justified we may feel about doing it. And just as adultery leads to jealousy, so spiritual adultery does the same. In Psalm 78 and verses 58 and 59 we read, they angered him, that's God, with their high places. They aroused his jealousy with their idols. When God heard them, he was very angry. He rejected Israel completely. It is because God is a jealous God and will not stand for spiritual adultery that he gave us this second commandment. And not only will he not stand for it, we find both in those verses of Psalm 78 that I've just read and here in our commandment that there are consequences of committing spiritual adultery. So we turn finally to the consequences. Third part of verse 5 and verse 6. If we have problems accepting the jealousy of God, we will no doubt have problems here as well. For the first thing that we are told is the consequence of idolatry, the consequence of idol worship, is that God will punish you. Perhaps in a sense we can understand that. But he says he will punish not only those who indulge in it, but also their children to the third and fourth generation. Why should my grandchildren suffer because of what my grandfather did or the like? Before we try to understand what this means, let's notice the force of what's being said here. For God goes on to say, of those who hate me, to the third and fourth generation of those that hate me. In other words, God is saying that those who indulge in idolatry or image worship are showing their hatred of him. We might be tempted to say, mightn't we, that this is a bit strong? And we might be right, for the word hate may mean not that they hate him, but that they're simply indifferent to him. But we need to look at it from God's point of view and not our own. In Deuteronomy 16 and verses 21 to 22, God says, do not set up any wooden Asherah poles beside the altar you build to the Lord your God. And do not erect a sacred stone, for these the Lord your God hates. God hates. And this time it is a strong word, meaning hostile mind. Idols and image worship, and therefore treats all who so indulge as those who hate him. It's how God sees it. So let's look at the consequences of breaking it. The punishment of the father and succeeding generations. Now, in some senses, it's difficult to discover exactly what this means. But even by looking on the surface, we can surely see something of what it means. What happens when a man hates God or is indifferent to God? What does he do when he's bringing up his children? He doesn't bring them up in the fear of God, does he? He doesn't believe in God, so he doesn't get his children to believe in God. He's going to bring them up in his own way, without God. And then what is that child likely to do? He is likely to bring up his children without God. Isn't that what we've got in this country today? Don't we have people in this country today who have gone away from God? Whole families that have gone away from God. We can go back and we can see to some extent, it's probably been going downhill for a long time, but when I was in Suffolk, in the church in Suffolk, there were whole families. There were the children, there were the mothers and fathers, there were the grandfathers, there were the great-grandfathers, all had a history of Christianity. And that's begun to go. It's begun to erode. And what happens when that sort of thing goes on? The third and fourth generation don't know anything about God. Like it or not, agree with it or not, I think we have to accept that our actions as parents colour in some way the way our children and possibly our grandchildren act as well. That's not to say we not necessarily need to blame ourselves if our children aren't Christians. We know it doesn't quite work like that. But our example has a marked effect upon them, doesn't it? It's not we, but they who reap what we sow. We don't give them the opportunity. But this is not the only consequence of the second commandment. And let me say right away that we have a merciful God. And although I've said all I have done about parents, grandparents, so on, not believing in God and not teaching God, that doesn't mean to say those children can't come to God through Jesus Christ. There is always that opportunity, but the basic point is there. But this is not the only consequence of the second commandment. There is another one. This time, it's not the consequence of disobeying it, but the consequence of obeying it. Those who obey the command, we are told here, as we are throughout the Bible, are those who are said to love God. And those who love God can be assured of his love, or as the AV has it, mercy in return. This love or mercy means more than meets the eye. For the original word was an all-encompassing one, indicating grace, favour and mercy. In contrast to the three or four generations of those who hate him, we have here 1,000 generations of those that love him. The contrast, between the consequences of disobedience and obedience is vast. Which would you prefer? The command, you shall not make for yourself an idol. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. When we look into the Old Testament, we see clearly the idols that were made and worshipped. But do we see them today? Many are not obvious, but they're still there. There are some, of course, that are so obvious that we wonder in the light of the commandment how they can remain. But remain they do. And they do so by ignoring the commandment. Others are less obvious, even within the church. The form or style of our worship, the version of the Bible we use, the hymn book we use, or the church we worship in. These things can become idols. These things were and still are intended to help our worship, to help our worship of God, and not to be worshipped in and of themselves. It's even possible, isn't it? For the culture of the day to become an idol as we concentrate on what will attract them into the church rather than concentrating on God. These things can become our idols and they can take away from God what is due to him. The cause, we serve a jealous God who only wants the best for us and from us. We serve a God who will defend and insist on his rightful place in our hearts. The consequences. There are two sets of consequences. One for those who disobey and therefore show their hatred of or indifference to God. And the second set for those who love him. Those who are indifferent will in some way be punished, along with possibly three or four generations, while those who love him will be blessed along with 1,000 generations. Where is your worship directed? To idols or to God? What is the root of your worship? From your heart to God via some idol? Or from your heart direct to God? We're going to sing as we close the hymn, "Oh, for a closer walk with God, a calm and heavenly frame, a light to shine upon the road that leads me to the Lamb." And I think it's verse 5 which speaks about